This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Marla Damati. On the show this Monday morning, there's hundreds of workers in Timor-Leste who are fully vaccinated and ready to come to Australia through the seasonal worker scheme. But the Australian government have not yet cleared them for arrival, despite farmers here in Australia calling for more help. And what did you make of the recent Pacific Islands Forum meeting? Well, a lot of the headlines pointed to cultural etiquette or lack thereof, but there's a new handbook that's been written by the Secretariat of the Pacific Community about Pacific cultural etiquette.
It's a cultural etiquette book that anyone coming into the Pacific can pick up and use.
But next, is kava set to be grown in the Queensland town of Bundaberg? Well, you'll find out. Attempts to persuade the Australian government to allow kava to be imported in commercial quantities are yet to come to fruition, with proposed trials being delayed by the pandemic. In recent weeks, even the small amounts that are allowed to come in from the Pacific have, well, dried up, forcing sellers to turn to New Zealand for supplies. But now, as Megan Hughes reports, there's a twist with a city in Queensland, more famous for its rum, seeking not to import kava, but to grow it.
The Bundaberg Regional Council has made a submission to the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade to trial kava production in Australia. Chairman of the Vanuatu Kava Industry Association, Michael Luze, said he was shocked.
My first thought, I was a bit disgusted, you know, because Australia has banned kava for more than 15 years now. And just to say that they're going to grow it now when it's becoming one of the major sources of income for small farmers in the South Pacific. They say they're going to grow it themselves. So it's very hypocrite from them to do that.
The idea was formed as the Bundaberg Council enters into a sister city arrangement with Luganville in Vanuatu. Bundaberg Mayor Jack Dempsey says it's about working with Pacific Island communities.
We're looking at how we can look for innovation, science, how we can value add. I think as the conversation with kava expands and how we can support the islands, we can actually be assistance to them to look to even, you know, things that we haven't even thought of in relation to value adding, but also as a way that if there is any possibilities of reduction in the types of areas we're growing would take place, that we would be seen as a place of support for them on the islands to make kava a significant more benefit in their own islands.
For the uninitiated, kava is a drink made by crushing the roots and rhizome of the kava plant and mixing it with water. It's considered an essential part of traditional ceremonies for Pacific Island communities and is used in events like weddings and funerals, as Vanuatu's High Commissioner to Australia, Samson Vilvil-Faure, explains.
Kava is part of our ceremonial activities in the country. Whenever there's a, for example, if there's a wedding, there's a death, there's a chiefly ceremonial, we always use kava actually to do that. Now, when you look at it from the Western part of it, kava could be perceived actually as a mean to bring people together. I would say that, you know, it brings people together to come and sit together around kava and to drink kava and to talk around it. So there's more to kava than just the commercial side of it.
It's also consumed socially around the world, according to Mr. Luze.
You go to downtown Auckland and you have kava bars where you can just enjoy kava at night in a quiet environment, play games and things like this. You have probably something like 200, 250 kava bars in the US and in many other places.
Mr. Luze says while he was angered by the council's announcement, he does hope this could help Australia learn more about kava.
I think it will open the door for Australians to know a bit more kava, and that kava is the perfectly safe to consume daily, same as tea, same as coffee, same as cocoa. Like, you know, some people need to have their coffee in the morning to get a bit of a boost. And Australians will realize that it's exactly the same with kava. You have a kava in the afternoon to relax, same as you have a coffee in the morning to get a boost.
Australia banned imports more than 20 years ago due to the drink being abused in some remote Indigenous communities. You can't buy kava legally in Australia, but you can bring it in for personal use. A person is allowed up to 4 kilograms, and it can be only brought in if you're flying into the country. You can't post it. The federal government announced a small trial of commercial imports last year, which has been postponed until the end of 2021. As for growing the crop commercially in Australia, Mr. Luze is not so sure it would be successful anyway.
I don't believe that Australia will be able to grow kava on a big commercial scale, big quantity of kava on a big commercial scale. You know, the kava is not an easy crop. And the terroir, the weather, the soil will be totally different. So it will be not easy. And it's a long-term crop. It's not a one-year crop. It's a minimum of like 3-4 years before you can harvest it. Australia already has many labor issues in agriculture, and they need to import all the labor from the Pacific Islands. And kava is labor intensive, especially during the harvest. You can talk about mechanization and things like this. You know, Americans have tried it in Hawaii, and so far there have been, as I put it like this, very little success.
Chairman of the Vanuatu Kava Industry Association, Michael Luze there. The horticulture industry in Australia continues to face a critical labour shortage made worse by border closures enforced because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Thousands of Pacific Islanders and workers from Timor-Leste who've been given special permission to enter the country over the past year have helped, but farmers say many more are needed. One labour company says it has 700 double-vaccinated, COVID-free agricultural workers ready to fly in from Timor-Leste. And as Pip Courtney reports, the company says it's baffled by the Australian government's reluctance to clear the group for takeoff.
These workers from Timor-Leste have been coming to the Mossmont Nursery at Griffith in New South Wales every year for 5 years. It can be a long season with up to 9 months' work tending to almond, citrus and stone fruit trees grown for commercial orchardists. Jonathan Moss says his now highly skilled crew have an incredible work ethic.
Now have the ability to virtually run this company without needing steady supervision from myself. The Seasonal Workers program is a brilliant program and I hope it increases forever on. We couldn't do this job without them.
...2,000 kilometres to the north of Western Australia, Timor-Leste is one of the world's poorest countries. Jobs in Australia are prized.
In one day, I get the $10. So in Australia, I work in like 7:30 until to 4 o'clock. I earn $200.
I am very happy to make money to support my family, to buy my car or van business, and I make my house to support my family and my young sister or my young brother to school, studying in a university.
The money I use more for I build my own house in my country. So I feel, very, very important for me in I'm working in Australia.
Pip, the Seasonal Workers Program is pure aid. The guys come to Australia. They're paid the Australian award wage or more. And they take that money, it gets paid directly to them and it gets sent home to their family. It changes lives, and I'm very proud to be part of it.
There's just one problem in this mutually beneficial arrangement. Jonathan needs more staff, and his workers have friends and family queuing up to come. But Australia's currently closed borders are preventing that.
I would like to employ anywhere between 40 to 60 East Timorese, if possible, if the borders would open.
Marsha Kelly heads up International Mobility Services.
And they've got the international airport there. So.
Based in the East Timor capital of Dili, the Australian business screens foreign workers for jobs in horticulture, aged care and meat processing. It has 1,000 Timorese on its books, including those at Mosmont.
What we would consider, hard work and an average wage for them is life-changing. So it's like winning the lottery coming to Australia.
Applicants are screened for English skills, physical ability, previous employment and schooling.
And then we really match and do a skills analysis and match what is required by the employer or what they would like as their wish list, and then do the gap training so that they are pre-mobilised, ready to go and have the skills to be able to integrate really quickly into the workforce.
Marcia says she can supply Jonathan and other Australian farmers with more workers.
Absolutely. We have over 1,000 candidates that have been pre-screened, initial training done, English language testing. They're ready to go and it makes a perfect match. We've got the candidates and the farmers are desperate for workers.
And no one leaves unless they're double vaccinated and test negative to COVID.
We have about 70% of our candidates have had at least their first vaccination, and we are aiming to get those first 70 that we're wanting to come across vaccinated by the end of August for their second vaccination. So that will reduce the risk associated with potential COVID transference.
Quarantine can be done in their country, but IMS can't get approvals from Australia. Marcia claims she's asked what else they can do to clear workers to fly, but no answer.
If we're provided with exactly what's required to mitigate the risk to an acceptable level, we will do it in order to get the employees in, or the candidates and employees in, and obviously for the farmers to get the workers they need before the fruit falls off the trees and rots on the ground. Timor-Leste is 1 hour, and we have farmers here that are desperately crying out for workers. The bit in the middle is what we need to fix. We need quick decisions and quick solutions. It's fantastic that they're talking about new quarantine facilities being built, but that doesn't help right now when the farmers are desperate for workers right now.
With just a trickle of seasonal and Pacific Islander workers coming in, Jonathan Moss is baffled by the lack of action from state and federal governments.
It would make a massive difference to get the 700 people that IMS are speaking of to fulfil the massive labour shortages, not just with my company, but many other companies based in Griffith or around Australia in the horticulture farming area.
He fears come spring he'll be forced to knock back business.
It's very hard to pin down a reason or a way of getting these guys into the country smoothly without having running into a severe red tape. I'd like to see the political parties come together with probably, for our situation, New South Wales state parties, but to come together with farmers and determine what's the best way to get these guys here.
The federal government says it's up to the states to clear a path for the Timorese.
There's been opportunities for the states to take up quarantining opportunities in addition to the caps that they've set from companies, international health companies, that will do the quarantining for them from Pacific nations where the COVID threat isn't as great and do it responsibly and then put those workers out into the agricultural sector. But no state's taken that up. This is where the state ag ministers really needed to get in the room with their premier and their chief health officer and explain to them the importance of having a different system for agriculture in regional Australia.
It's a lot of back and forth, with the states claiming it's up to the federal government, which controls immigration, to provide quarantine facilities in Australia. And if getting more workers is frustrating, so too is using those already here. In Griffith, the citrus season's proving a cracker.
We've got a really great crop, good size, markets are looking good. We could just do with a few more pickers.
Being unable to harvest all her fruit in peak condition is hurting Joanna's business, especially as the lucrative China market rewards her with a premium for supplying in time for key celebrations.
I understand COVID is a pretty, you know, new and difficult time for us all, but there is an absolute need here out in the orchards to get a workforce out here. So, you know, surely there could be some ways. And like you say, if they're vaccinated and they're doing all the right things, what else can we do to try and get these workers, you know, here?
20 pickers short, Joanna wanted to use Jonathan's crew. It made sense, as winter's the nursery's quiet time and the orchard's busiest. The farmers would win and the workers could earn more money.
Absolutely. Like Jonathan and I talk and it's our frustration, you know. We can definitely always just, you know, even if it's a couple of days, it takes the pressure off him and it takes the pressure off us. But at the moment, we're not able to do that.
There are hopes the new agricultural visa announced in June will fix these problems. It should be in place before the end of the year, and David Littleproud says it will improve on the current systems.
We will work to make sure that it's as flexible as we possibly can to give that protection also to those workers and the Australian agricultural reputation that we need to uphold.
See you.
On Sundays, the Mosmont workers go to church. Father Andrew Grace says they've been embraced by the Griffith community and more would be welcome.
They come to Mass every Sunday here and they sing in our choirs and participate in other activities around the parish. It's truly a blessing to have them here and we pray that this may continue for many years to come. They bring a great culture of hard work and very community-minded. They're just bubbling with enthusiasm. They love being here and we love having them. So they're a great blessing.
Jonathan Moss says his crew is now part of the Mossmont family. He just wishes it could be bigger.
Thank you!
Thank you! Thank you.
Pip Courtney reporting there. Well, still to come on the program, we're going to get a wrap of news, a weather update, and you'll hear more about a handbook on Pacific Island etiquette. But some music for your Monday morning. I want to start your morning with a bit of Rhythm and Truth by Emily Mooley.
R stands for the riot in me, revolution in me, rise up now. H for a higher purpose, touching heaven's surface when you hear that sound. Y for why not? Why don't we yield and give this thing a shot? Maybe the thum thum of the rhythm thum won't give you what you want. Rhythm, rhythm and truth, rhythm and truth. I give you rhythm, rhythm and truth. Rhythm and truth, I'll give you rhythm. Rhythm and truth. Rhythm and truth, I'll give you. I give you rhythm and truth.
Tea means tasty on my temple. Make me tremble when you take out that treble. And I for relax, make it simple. Then run it back one time for the rebel.
Bit of Rhythm and Truth for your morning. That was Rhythm and Truth by Emily Mooley. Well, it's time now to take a look at some of the other stories making headlines in the Pacific this morning. Richard Hewitt is with me this morning. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Marla.
We take a start with the latest on the COVID-19 situation in Fiji.
We do, and this is a concern, I would suggest, with the first case of community transmission being recorded in the country's northern division. Vanuatu, Fiji's second largest island, had been COVID-free since the latest outbreak began back in April, with infections confined to the western and northern divisions. The Permanent Secretary for Health, Dr. James Fong, has told the Fijian media they're trying to determine how the infected person, who is a wharf worker, contracted the virus, but they are working on the theory that exposure occurred on board a ship while cargo cargo was being unloaded. Dr. Fong says members of the men's household are in quarantine, but so far they have all tested negative. Across the country, the number of COVID-19 cases continues to rise, up by 314 during the latest reporting period, with eight more deaths, taking the total close to 370. Meanwhile, Nick McClellan from Ireland's Business Magazine has been tweeting to highlight concerns over the situation in French Polynesia, with case numbers outside Tahiti on the rise, including on Makatea Atoll, which had been COVID-free up to now.
Now we're turning to Samoa, because there's been plenty of talk about the judiciary in the country, not least from the former Prime Minister Tuiloiapa. And now there's a bit of a twist, because there have been some new appointments. Can you tell me a bit more?
I can. This is interesting. A statement from the Samoan Judicial Commission confirming that five judges from the New Zealand High Court have been recruited on a temporary basis to assist the local bench. They've been sworn in by video link and expected to take part in some upcoming cases of contempt of court. Also some appeals, we're told. The commission statement says, and I quote, "The external oversight of judgment on these matters is paramount, and it won't be appropriate for local judges to deal with them." Now, the sting in the tail is that one of those facing contempt charges is the former Prime Minister Tuiloiapa, accusations linked to his refusal to follow a Supreme Court directive to recall Parliament back in late May. So as and when that comes to court, going to be very interesting.
I feel like a lot of eyes will be turning to Samoa at that point. Now a bit of sports news from Scotland, but it has a very strong Pacific connection there.
Yeah, this says so much really about what's happening in the sporting world as far as Pacific Island players are concerned. Edinburgh Eagles are celebrating winning the National Rugby League title in Scotland for a record 11th time, and they've done it with a contingent of Fijian players in the ranks. A number of those players are serving in the British Armed Forces and based in the Scottish capital, while other players are family members or friends of the soldiers. The Eagles chairperson, Barry McGuffog, great name, says the Fijians bring so much both on and off the field, telling the website Everything Rugby League that on field there's their obvious presence, physicality and exciting style of play, and off field the culture and passion for the game. And apparently, 2 years ago, the Edinburgh Eagles fielded a junior team which was entirely made up of players of Fijian origin, all of whom are or would be qualified to play for Scotland. So you begin to understand the eligibility problems that they have in the Pacific. Getting access to players are getting ever more complicated. If an entire Scottish team could be of Fijian origin, yeah, it's a crazy thought, but it could happen.
It could happen, but it just shows how, you know, rugby and sport mad Fiji is, that they're kind of spreading throughout the world, and we're seeing players all across the nation and all across the world, actually. But, Richard, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
No problem, Marla.
Hi, I'm Daly Cherry Evans from the Manly Seagulls.
This is Clint Gutherson from the Parramatta Eels.
The 2021 NRL Premiership, live on ABC Radio Australia.
40 to run!
Every try.
Four tries in 14 minutes.
Every game-winning moment.
Pangai infield to Asako. Asako scores!
Live and loud on ABC Radio Australia.
Jump all the way to Burton. Got straight past Tyson Frizzell.
Back on the inside for Ikevalu. Beautiful stuff from Matty Kevalu
to Brayan. And he flies through the air.
The NRL 2021 season.
And that pass was Jerome Luai poetry.
ABC Radio Australia, your home of NRL in the Pacific.
Oh, this is absolute rugby league heaven.
Before we get a weather update, here's another song for your morning. This is Breathe by Lapani.
It's called a past, will never last. That's what I said that night, Amore. Spent the day not talking about our problems and feel that I'm sorry. One day when we look back, we can laugh at the moments we thought were nothing more we could have kicked back. I can tell that you're embarrassed, I am too. It's so easy when I'm off track. I lose sight of the feeling that I had when I first said I love you. So in my good days, in my bad nights, I promise you that in your good days, in your bad nights, I'll be with you.
That was Fijian-born artist Lapani there with his track Breathe. Well, it is Monday morning, so it's time for a weather update. And joining me is Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather Bulla. And good morning, Neville.
Hi, Marla.
Now, the weather outlook for the region this week, it's looking pretty settled but a bit cooler.
Yes, we have enjoyed some cooler than average weather across much of the Pacific, thanks to the prevailing trade winds, which are really quite fresh at the moment, stretching all the way from French Polynesia all the way into the Coral Sea into Torres Strait. So it's a very stable weather pattern, unlikely to change much. So we do expect weather to stay pretty settled across most parts of the region through the first half of the week anyway. About the only places that we'll see any significant weather are along the windward coasts of the larger islands, where the onshore trade winds, being as fresh and strong as they are, may just kick off a few trade wind showers along the mountains and coastal regions there. So thinking particularly here of places like Suva, Port Vila, it could be a few, also about New Caledonia. But other than that, not much happening in our hemisphere.
Well, speaking of that, I feel like a lot of the action is happening north of the equator. Is there anything that we're keeping our eye on at the moment?
No, things have quietened down up there as well for the moment, which is nice for them. We did have quite a bit of activity a week or so back, but it should stay quiet up there, I would say, through to the end of the month. Quite a bit of cyclone activity now happening across in the Atlantic. A couple of very significant systems. Very sadly, it looks like we're going to have a significant tropical cyclone cross the island of Hispaniola. The western half of that island is, of course, the country of Haiti, and they've just gone through another devastating earthquake. So it's not looking all that good for folks in around Haiti and the Dominican Republic anyway. And there's also another tropical storm heading up into Florida. So it's all happening that side. And we have a bit of a quiet spell around the North and South Pacific west of the dateline.
Well, a quiet spell hopefully means a bit of reprieve. But Neville, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, and perhaps just one more quick thing, if I can just jump in.
Of course.
It looks like the latest climate advice does point strongly towards us in the Pacific enjoying or experiencing another La Nina-like year. We had a significant La Nina event through last summer. Conditions appear to be now, as we near spring, settling into certainly on the cool side of the ENSO circulation, which means either La Nina or almost La Nina, but certainly the signs of any El Nino are long gone, and there's no sign that we experience any significant El Nino-like impact. So this summer may pan out much like we saw last summer, with rainfall average or slightly above average across much of the region.
Well, definitely something we'll keep our eye on for that La Nina forecasting. But thank you so much again, Neville.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. And for weather updates at any time, just head on over to Facebook and search in Nandraki Weather. Well, one of the unexpected headlines to come out of the recent Pacific Island Forum leaders retreat was prompted by the sight of Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison eating and drinking while other leaders were speaking. The meeting was happening over Zoom, and the vision drew pointed remarks from some observers who described it as disrespectful of certain Pacific Island customs. It draws into focus the complex rules of Pacific cultural etiquette, which are outlined in a booklet published by the Secretariat of the Pacific Community. Nick Fogarty has been speaking to one of the creators, SPC's Polynesia Regional Director, Leituala Kunisalani Tolupe Tango Elisara. Now, she concedes that while the booklet is useful for anyone engaging with the region, the application of cultural etiquette in a virtual COVID-influenced world throws up some new challenges.
Originally, the booklet is essentially for SPC staff. But as we were developing it, this second edition, you know, it really kind of generated a lot of interest from our partners, you know, working with us, DFAT and MFAT. You know, we're really keen to use it and to also look at how their own teams and staff could apply this as they work and engage in Pacific communities. So most definitely, it's a cultural etiquette book that anyone coming into the Pacific can pick up and use.
And there's a lot of detailed information on every Pacific country's particular customs. Who did you have input from in getting that expert knowledge to put the guide together?
So the second edition was developed with inputs from representatives of countries and territories who had responsibility for culture, or those who are from the ministries or departments of culture. We were also fortunate to be able to gather inputs from our main focal points and countries, which is our ministries of foreign affairs or the equivalents. And, you know, this process ensured that the content was informed by the perspectives and inputs from the Pacific people themselves, and that it truly captured the nuances of our diverse Pacific cultures and who we are.
I guess from my perspective as a white Australian, I guess I've grown up in a culture where there is relatively few or less cultural etiquette and customs. Do you think there are more kind of specific customs in the Pacific Islands, and do you think they're particularly important in Pacific Island nations compared to other regions?
Perhaps I can't speak for other regions or other nations, but I do acknowledge that we all share similar values and concepts around cultural etiquette and what is considered appropriate cultural protocols in whichever context. But certainly for the Pacific, the importance of understanding context, which includes an understanding of cultural etiquette and customs of Pacific countries and territories, is indeed critical. Because, you know, context is everything in the Pacific. As we seek to engage Pacific countries in the work that we do as regional public servants, we need that basic understanding of context to enable us to make connections on the ground. And it's really about having an appreciation and respect for those protocols and dynamics, because for one, it will have a great impact on the way we engage with Pacific people in terms of relationship building and in the way we build partnerships on the ground. And secondly, it's also about ensuring sustained relationships and connections at national level, all of which are critical in the work that we do. I'd also like to think that, you know, it's kind of basic common sense that this is what we do when we plan to visit places that we're not familiar with. We find out what we can about the people, about the culture, about their ways of life and so forth before we even travel there. And it's the same thing in this context. Before we go on a mission to any Pacific countries, that's what we do. And that's why we have a cultural etiquette book.
In the last year and a half, so much of our lives has been lived online over video chats. Have you noticed how any particular customs have had to be modified for these online scenarios?
I suppose what you're really asking is the application of cultural etiquette when it comes to virtual convenings and engagements. I think we must acknowledge that this sudden change and shift in the way we work and in the way we engage with our target audience has been and continues to be difficult and challenging for all of us. Now, to attempt the application of the cultural etiquette guidelines onto what is already a challenging layer makes the whole experience even more challenging. But take this from the perspective of someone who's convened several regional meetings of ministers, senior officials, in person prior to COVID, and also in the last 18 months through virtual platforms. My own personal view is this: the same values and principles informing how we should engage with Pacific peoples and communities in person should also apply when we engage virtually. Now, we know that it's a lot harder to engage virtually. And before COVID, when face-to-face meetings was the norm, we would easily get away with some of these things and some of these nuances when we engage in person. But in a virtual context, it's a lot harder. And this makes it even more important for us to demonstrate our respect and our adherence to those cultural protocols. Otherwise, it will impact on our relationships with our Pacific members and could potentially present some reputational risks in terms of how we would be perceived as regional public servants if we don't respect those cultural protocols.
In that context, the other day, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison was criticised for some of his conduct, maybe lack of etiquette on a call with Pacific leaders. Did you see that? And why do you think that criticism did go to him?
I didn't see that, Nick, but I prefer not to comment on that.
The SPC's Polynesia Regional Director, Letuala Kuinesalani Tope Tango Elisara, speaking to Nick Fogarty. Here's a track from Solomon Islands to get you through Monday morning. This is Mama Kalilena featuring Cape Henslow.
You're the mama everyone we still have. Mama saw you're the most beautiful flowers. Yeah, your eyes the purest, your smiles are bright in my day. God bless you, Mama. Your love, your ways, your hope, your soul. Pretend to believe you carry.
That was Kelly Lena featuring Cape Henslow from Souls with Mama. Seeing the music, feeling the rhythm and connecting to the beat. Well, that's how the deaf Indigenous dance group perform their culture, even though they can't hear. Carly Willis spoke to one of the group's leaders, Yalanji woman Patty Morris Banjo, about what exactly they do. Because Patty is deaf, you're going to hear the voice of her Auslan or Australian Sign Language interpreter, Susanna Jackson.
I'm very, very excited and in love with this place. I have such a passion for it and to keep coming back because it's part of my culture. And when we come to Laura, we get to see the variation in culture and language that's all around from Cape York and all around Australia. And I love the introductions to family and friends. We started coming here when I was really young and it was small back then, back probably in the 80s. I can't remember actually what date, but I would just join in with family, and as it grew, it was fantastic. My auntie, whose surname is Banjo, I would come with her, and I, you know, wouldn't see so many family members for such a long time, and we would all meet up here. It was a meeting place for us, and we just love coming every year so that we can meet up with people. And I never thought that I would dance here one day in the future, but yeah, now we have, and obviously we missed out last year, but it's great to be back this year, and I just feel really in awe of the place. My friends in the deaf dance group in the troupe come from all different areas all over Cape York, and we decided many years ago, that was 1998, to establish our group. That was DIG. It was called Deaf Indigenous Dance Group, and we just try and get whatever funds we can to give the deaf Indigenous people who comprise the troupe opportunity to come and dance, to feel the beat through the ground. Usually we will practice on wooden stage so that they can feel the drums, feel the tapping of the sticks, and it's just such a great opportunity for everyone to come together from all over the place. Sometimes deaf Indigenous people can feel disconnected from the deaf community and from the greater community because, you know, we were often, some of us stolen from our communities to be brought to Cairns, taken from country and had to learn a different language, and that was really difficult for a lot of us. I was lucky in Laura, we had a sign language and so my parents were able to talk to me, but yeah, that was Jelbina. It's called Jelbina, stands for dingo's ears. And so I would come there, but often I would not want to go to school there. And I would, yeah, sometimes run away, and I was a bit cheeky girl.
I'm at the Laura Quinquen Dance Festival on the stunning Quinquen country.
And I'm talking to Paddy Morris-Banjo, a dancer in the Deaf Indigenous Dance Group. Paddy is signing to an interpreter, Susanna Jackson, who is translating that for us.
My family would ask me, come on, come and dance with us, but I was quite shy as a child and I couldn't hear, so I just felt a bit, you know, left out sometimes. And then my brother said to me, just come and dance. And I realised that I could dance with or without music and I could just feel something inside myself. And whether it was at home or on the stage, I was able to do it.
When was the first time dancing at Laura Dance Festival?
This is our first time dancing here, the Deaf Indigenous Dance Group. We were really fighting to get in here. And back then, my best friend Priscilla Seedon, she was the president of many years, but she unfortunately died a few years back. And it was her passion to dance, and we dance today, yeah, in memory of her. And, you know, we especially wanted to dance in memory of her today because she was here from the beginning. Yeah, it's really a dream come true for us.
How do you hear the beat? Do you feel it in the ground? Can you also feel the audience clapping and cheering you on?
Yeah, so we respond to vibrations and we respond to the ground, and we can link to the music through our eyes, and we have to practice a lot to get to the beat, that's for sure. The clap sticks are easy to follow. Some of us have some residual hearing, so we can follow the clap sticks, yeah, but others just feel it. It's just a rhythm. When I was growing up, I started ballet at a young age, and my foster mother, she put me into ballet classes, and I realised that I was the only black girl within a white class, and that was funny, but they loved me and they included me in the ballet. And myself and another girl, we danced together, and that's how I learnt to dance, and the floor was wooden, and so I could dance jazz with her and I could watch her move and we could dance together. And the first time I danced on the stage was probably at 10 years old, and there was all hearing people and there was only two of us deaf girls, but we danced perfectly and to the beat, and everyone was so impressed. And I couldn't see the audience and I couldn't hear the clapping at that time, and it was very dark in the auditorium and we weren't sure what was happening. But our teacher came, our ballet teacher, and she said, please give a round of applause for the two deaf girls in the dance group. And the crowd just lost it, and I could see my foster mum there in the crowd, and she was so passionate and clapping, and yeah, and we were two little deaf girls dancing in a ballet, and you know, people just would never have known. So we can do it. We're deaf, but we can dance, and we do love music and dance.
You said on stage that whilst you were adopted, you made it back home to your mum. Is that right?
Well, it's kind of a long story. But when I was two, the welfare system did take me away. That was called the Stolen Generation, and that was at the end of the Stolen Generation in the early 80s. So I was one of the last, and because I'm light-skinned, my mother is full Aboriginal and she wasn't allowed to be with a white European at that time. That was the law. And also I had I was a bit sick at the time, perhaps with the mumps, but they weren't sure what it was. So there, you know, might have been some other problems in the community. But no, I hadn't seen her for 30 years. But Percy knew my father, John Morris, and he used to work at the Laura Pub, Laura Quinkham Pub. And that's where I grew up, with Percy Tresice there. And I was 2 years old when I was fostered by them. And they really searched everywhere for a special education unit to send me to that was for deaf children. And I was sent down to Cairns West, to state school in Cairns. And we started at preschool. And, yeah, I grew up there as part of the deaf unit, met all the deaf friends, and I would travel back and forward. And Percy gave me that opportunity, I guess. But that obviously was originated with, you know, firstly being taken by welfare, but, yeah.
Yeah.
Carly Willis with that story. You've been with me, Marla Damati, for the first hour of Pacific Beat, but stick around because still to come, Vanuatu's controversial citizenship program has revoked the citizenship of one Syrian national, while people in the country want to see the program reform. And COVID-19 has meant that many can't be there when a family member or a loved one passes away. But social media is playing a big role in sharing comfort and grief. But is there social and cultural awarenesses that need to take place when it comes to online funerals in the Pacific? Well, you'll find out in about 15 minutes' time. And although the bat has had a bit of a public relations nightmare with its links to COVID-19, the flying mammal is actually very important for the ecosystem in the Pacific. News is next, but then stick around for more stories on Pacific Beat. Good morning. Welcome to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia on this Monday morning. I'm Marla Damati. Well, coming up in this hour of the program, what is the protocol for live streaming or sharing a funeral on social media? The pandemic has changed the way we celebrate a life and grieve, but are there cultural sensitivities around social media and funerals in the Pacific? Well, you'll find out in about 5 minutes' time. Also, do you know much about bats? Well, if you answered no, stick around because in about 30 minutes' time, you'll hear from a regional expert and hint bats are actually very important in the Pacific. But next, there's been more issues with Vanuatu's Cash for Citizenship program. The head of Vanuatu's Citizenship Commission says a Syrian national has had his approval for citizenship revoked and others are being investigated over concerns that international criminals are buying Vanuatu passports. It comes after a media report last month revealed the identities of some of the people who have gained Vanuatu's citizenship through the controversial program, from fugitives, politicians, to disgraced business people from across the world, including Australia. While controversial, the program remains extremely lucrative, reaching a record high last year, helping the country avoid a major economic shock from the collapse of international tourism. But as Evan Wasuka reports, critics are calling for the program to be reformed.
Vanuatu is known as one of the happiest places on Earth, according to the Happy Planet Index. And the price tag for a piece of that happiness is an expensive one at $150,000, which investors have been willing to pay to become citizens. The chair of Vanuatu's Citizenship Commission, Ronald Wassell, says even a global pandemic and the closure of international borders hasn't dampened interest in the scheme.
From our record, the numbers that we're getting, such as last year and this year, are similar, same. Nothing has changed. Yes, I think people are looking beyond COVID-19 and a post-COVID-19, right?
How many people do you usually get applying for these type of things?
Probably per month, probably about 100, maybe 70 to 100,
The sale of citizenship is lucrative business. The $175 million it earned last year helped Vanuatu weather the economic storm caused by the COVID-19 pandemic and the collapse of its main revenue stream, tourism. But the scheme has been mired in controversy, with claims it's being used by international criminals to access Vanuatu passports and to a safe haven from the law. The case of Syrian businessman Abdul Rahman Kitty was first raised in July when The Guardian newspaper reported that his citizenship application was approved just weeks after the US government placed sanctions on his business. His application was approved in April, but then it was revoked last week.
After the article came out in The Guardian, and then during the course of the further investigations by the Financial Intelligence Unit, to revoke the approval in principle for the grant of this citizenship and have it all revoked and forfeit all the funds that he had paid into government coffers.
To obtain Vanuatu citizenship, applicants must not have a criminal record or any adverse reports against them when a check is done by the country's Financial Intelligence Unit. Mr. Wassell says others who have also been granted citizenship, including those named in the Guardian article, will also be scrutinized.
We have requested investigation on on other people as well, not only those mentioned in the article. We want to ensure that the people that come here to Vanuatu or who obtain Vanuatu citizens are not people that are wanted abroad or people who the Guardian said are fugitives, right?
The CEO of Transparency International Vanuatu, Dr. Willie Tokon, says it's worrying that the Syrian businessman was able to get approval in the first place and that it was only revoked when the matter was raised in the media.
My worry was, how come we have all these allegations, but the screening by the Citizenship Commission and the Financial Intelligence Unit did not come up with these allegations?
He says if Vanuatu doesn't have the capacity to thoroughly vet applicants, it should seek help from Interpol and other agencies.
There's no other way to do it than do it properly. If we don't have the capacity, we actually have a strong support from Australian government in terms of the AFP that are here with us. They're providing a lot of support.
But Mr. Wassell doesn't agree. He says the government has systems in place to deal with character checks of those applying.
To the final decision, but the process, once that application comes in, goes through certain processes, and then it will decide and make a decision. We've got the immigration, we've got all the others, we've got our attorney general's office are involved, FIU, we've got the police, our Interpol here, so it's a teamwork.
Dr. Tokon says there should also be limits on the number of citizenships sold to avoid Vanuatu being overrun by foreigners. As for the scheme itself, he says public support is mixed, with many in the older generations who took part in Vanuatu's fight for independence in the 1970s against it.
There are some of us who are 60 years old and above. We don't like this idea of selling passports because, you know, some of us, some relatives died, some were treated very badly, are totally against it. You know, we fought for this identity. Why are we selling it?
Dr. Willie Tokon, CEO of Transparency International Vanuatu, ending that report from Evan Wasuka. When a loved one passes away, often our immediate urge is to reach for our family and our friends. But in an era of COVID-19, with international borders closed, sometimes it's just not possible to be there in person. As a result, many Pacific Islanders are choosing to live stream funerals online so that loved ones stuck overseas can still pay their respects. But as Marion Farr reports, it raises tricky questions about what is culturally appropriate and where to draw the line when broadcasting funerals on social media.
When Joanne Ioane got the news that her mother-in-law was going to die, all she wanted was to fly to Samoa and be by her side.
Because we'd always agreed that if anything happened to one of them, at least my husband, probably all our family would go over.
Instead, Ms. Ioane was stuck in regional Australia, where she lives with her children and husband, who is Samoan. With international borders closed, there was no way they could leave.
The doctors said that she had cancer in the liver and stomach and there was nothing they could do. And so that was about 2 days later she passed away. So it was really quick and unexpected, which probably made it harder.
Ms. Ioane says the tragedy took a toll on her family, but she found some solace in being able to watch her mother-in-law's funeral when it was live streamed on Facebook.
I think it just allowed us to really, like, we all cried together. It allowed us to really, I suppose, have that ritual that was a bit familiar, having a funeral that we could sort of in our own way, you know, together share our memories of her and I guess just grieve together.
Live streaming major events like weddings and funerals has become increasingly common during the pandemic. Manuha Apai Gagatoranga runs a video production business in Fiji's capital, Suva. The company used to make advertisements, but since the global pandemic began and they lost commercial clients, they've focused almost entirely on funerals.
We've been doing so many funerals that I've lost count of how many events we've done in this past month alone.
Fiji is grappling with a large outbreak of the COVID-19 Delta variant, with 360 reported deaths so far. Mrs. Gagatoranga says about 50% of the funerals she's filmed are COVID-19 related.
It takes its toll on our staff and sometimes they break down right there and then. You know, they're holding the cameras and we see the tears streaming down their faces, and that's only because they have they have an emotional connection to the person.
Despite the challenges, Mrs. Gagotaranga says her business is providing an important service, and the numbers don't lie. Some of the funeral videos have racked up 500,000 views online.
For us, we want the send-off to be a beautiful one, and we try and do everything the family is requesting. Everything is personalised for them.
But she says the situation raises some ethical issues, like whether or not to film the body of a deceased person.
Our main goal is to protect the deceased and give them a dignified way of being buried or being cremated as much as we can. We don't want to show them as dead people on live stream or on air. It's not our ethics.
But she says there are rare occasions where she'll make an exception based on a family's wishes.
Especially for Indian funerals, they need to see that the person is dead. The person has passed on in order for them to get closure. So that for us, we allow it if they want it.
The use of social media in funeral settings has sparked debate among Pacific Islanders. Leo Falili Dionanari is a PhD candidate at Bond University in Australia. He's been researching the use of digital technology in funeral practices among Maori and Samoan communities during the pandemic. He's discovered some stark differences in how the two cultures view social media.
The Maori community, they did not film the tūpapaku or the deceased body out of tapu. They believed that the body was tapu, meaning bound by sacredness as to why one shouldn't film the body. So that was really interesting, because what we had found throughout the Samoan community is many of them were taking photos of the deceased within 5 or 10 minutes of them passing away. We could see the contrast and the similarities. It was really interesting.
And even within the Samoan community, people have differing views.
So I saw filming and photographing of the deceased with the family's blessings and there being no issues or problems. But I also saw some Samoan families who had issues with their deceased bodies being photographed and put on Facebook. So, yeah, there was a mix of those who enjoyed the process and embraced it, and then others who didn't.
Taking selfies with deceased bodies is a trend Joanne Ioane has also noticed among Samoans, particularly young people.
And some of our nieces and nephews did it, took photos with our mother-in-law when she was dead in her coffin, like selfies, and we sort of found that a little bit disrespectful. Yeah, and I think that's something that a lot of Samoans have been sort of debating about as well. I guess with the younger generation trying to work out what is respectful and what's not, because they think it's just kind of cool and they're just showing how they loved their grandma and they're saying goodbye to her. But to us, it's like, oh, I don't know that we want that publicly on Facebook.
It's a complex issue that everyone in the Pacific is trying to navigate. But Leo Falili Dionanari says there are some big positives to come out of the use of social media.
One family service that I saw, which was so cool, was a Samoan man in California's funeral. However, his family from Asia, Europe, Australia, New Zealand and Samoa all had a virtual choir and sang together for his funeral that was in California. So, yeah, the digital space has really truly allowed us to remain connected at a physical distance.
That's PhD candidate Leo Falili Dionanari ending Marion Farr's report with additional reporting by Inga Stunzner. What do you think of social media at the time of funerals and COVID-19? A personal story of my own is that my cousin and my uncle passed away from COVID-19 back in Indonesia a couple weeks ago. And in traditional Islamic burial practices, you have to bury a body within 24 hours of them passing away, which made it really difficult for my family here in Australia, who wanted to be there and pay their respects because of border closures. My father couldn't go back to Indonesia for the burial process, but was able to stay connected to his family and our family back home through social media. So I know how important and how, you know, strong that connection is, and why social media is so important in this time where we can't physically be together, but we can still feel like we can be together to celebrate someone's life and to grieve in our own way. But I would love to know what you think of social media and funerals in the time of COVID-19. Are you for them? Are you against them? Send me a message on our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. I would love to know your thoughts.
Conversations.
As a journalist in China, were you under surveillance by the state?
Spend an hour in the life of someone else.
We always worked on the assumption that the ABC Bureau office would be bugged.
Someone who has seen and done remarkable things.
So I didn't want to leave at all. I felt safe. And then at midnight, knock on the door, seven state security police.
Tune in to Conversations, 11 a.m. PNG time, weekdays on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, still to come on the program this morning, we talk bats, how important bats are to the ecology of the Pacific and what role they actually play in the ecosystem as well. That chat will be coming up very soon. And you'll also get a wrap of sports of the weekend and more with Richard Hewitt towards the end of the program. But first, a little bit more music for your Monday. This is Luana with Moonlight Madness.
When the moon is on the rise, soul is hypnotized. It moves me, soothes me, takes me on a ride. With Dr. Dr. to help me place, the moonlight's got a hold of me. It moves me, soothes me, takes me on a ride. Ooh, sunlight's all right. Keep my same tonight. I got the moonlight madness. Do not tick down round the clock. It's waiting and moving.
Ocean waves and crackling of a fire to end Luana's Moonlight Madness.
Hold the front page!
Well, it's time now to take a look on what's making news and some other headlines in the Pacific this morning. And Richard Hewitt joins me. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Marla.
Now, let's start with the latest of the COVID-19 situation in Fiji.
Yeah, we have the first case of community transmission being recorded in the country's northern division. Vanuatu, Fiji's second largest island, had been COVID-free since the latest outbreak began back in April, with infections confined to the western and northern divisions. The Permanent Secretary for Health, Dr. James Fong, he's told the Fijian media they are trying to determine how the infected person, who is a wharf worker apparently, contracted the virus, but they are working on the theory that exposure occurred on board a ship while cargo was being unloaded. Dr. Fong says that members of the man's household are in quarantine, but so far they have all tested negative. Across the country, the number of cases continues to rise, up by 314 during the latest reporting period. Eight more deaths also, taking the total close to 370 now. Meanwhile, Nick McClellan from Ireland's Business Magazine, he's tweeted concerns over the situation in French Polynesia, with case numbers outside Tahiti on the rise. You might remember French Polynesia had a problem, solved the problem, and then had another problem, and it now appears they've got a third problem, because for the first time, cases have been reported on Makatea Atoll, which had been COVID-free up to now.
Well, we're turning now to Samoa because after months and months of political deadlock and issues, we've got a new prime minister. But there's been plenty of talk about the judiciary in Samoa, not least from the former prime minister himself, Tuila Eppa. And now there's a bit of a twist because there's been some new appointments.
Yeah, this is like a sort of game of political poker that's going on in Samoa. And what we have is a statement from the Samoan Judicial Commission confirming that five judges from the New Zealand High Court have been recruited on a temporary basis to assist the local bench. They've been sworn in by video link. They're expected to take part in some upcoming appeals and also some cases of contempt of court. The commission statement says, and I quote, "The external oversight of judgment on these matters is paramount, and it won't be appropriate for local judges to deal with them." The sting in the tail is that one of those facing contempt charges is the former Prime Minister Tuila Eppa. Accusations linked to his refusal to follow a Supreme Court directive to recall Parliament back in late May. Now, bearing in mind he and HRPP have been protesting or advising, depending on your point of view, about the state of the judiciary in Samoa, it's very interesting that these judges will be brought in and presumably will sit in judgment on him when his case comes to court.
It will also be interesting to see some of the commentary to come out, whether or not people think that they will be unbiased, being from New Zealand and not within Samoa itself. I think when Tuila Eppa does stand up and when this court case does come to fruition, a lot of eyes will be turning on Samoa. But now a bit of sports news from Scotland. A taste potentially of what we're going to get towards the end of the show. But this one is sports news from Scotland, and it has a strong Pacific connection. Who's the connection? What's the story? Tell me more.
Okay, Edinburgh Eagles is the team. They're a rugby league team, and they've won the National Rugby League title in Scotland for a record 11th time. And they've done it with a fairly substantial contingent of Fijian players in the ranks. These guys are players serving in the British Armed Forces and based in the Scottish capital, or otherwise players' family members or friends of the soldiers. So they've joined forces to get the Eagles over the line. The chairperson of the Eagles, a guy called Barry McGuffog, amazing name, says the Fijians bring so much both on and off the field. He's told the website Everything Rugby League. On field, there's the obvious presence, physicality and exciting style of play. Off field, the culture and passion for the game. So big Fijian influence there. And apparently 2 years ago, the Eagles actually fielded a junior team that was entirely made up of players of Fijian origin, all of whom, incidentally, are qualified to play for Scotland. So just a few years from now, you could see a situation in the Rugby League World Cup where Fiji plays Fiji.
I think it'll be definitely something really interesting to watch. But like you said, it could potentially also play tricky to some of that eligibility things that are kind of rolling out at the moment, those conversations that are happening. But Richard, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
No problem, Marla.
Big ideas on Radio Australia.
Driverless cars are currently being trialled in every Australian state and territory. It's early days and we're a long way from a future where autonomous vehicles rule. But the technology's developing fast. So why choose autonomous vehicles? Just because we can, should we?
Casting light on some of the big issues and challenges of our time.
A recent report by McKinsey & Co. predicts the winners and losers from automation and artificial intelligence.
On average, we'd see over the next decade or so, around 25% of jobs in the most likely scenario not required. Some industries will be hit harder than others. Transport and manufacturing, which will be increasingly automated.
And discussing age-old questions.
Do animals have emotions? This question is hotly contested.
Be part of the conversation with Big Ideas on Radio Australia.
Well, bats have had a pretty bad rap over the last 18 months, particularly when the creature was linked to the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. But bats and flying foxes play an incredibly important role in our ecosystem, even in the Pacific, but they're declining at an alarming rate. There's a new group in the Pacific called PacBat, which aims to bring together bat researchers and conservationists, and they recently held their first ever Pacific Island Bat Conference. One of its organisers and members of PacBat is bat ecologist Nicola Hanrahan, and she joins me now from Darwin. Good morning, Nicola.
Morning, Marla.
Now, Nicola, can you tell me a little bit more about what kinds of bats do we actually find in the Pacific?
Yeah, so in the Pacific, there's actually a huge diversity of bats. It'll be rivaling anywhere else in the world for its diversity. There's over 190 species known from that region. So in comparison, Australia has about 80 species. And they're, yeah, super diverse. So there's flying foxes, monkey face bats, microbats like the sheet-tail bats, tube nose bats, blossom bats. So there's really amazing species there. And often in Ireland, you know, will be home to just one of those species. So they're, yeah, super important.
Now, bats have had a bit of a bad rap recently, you know, across social media, across the news. But I think a lot of people don't actually know why bats are so important to the ecosystem and specifically the ecosystem in the Pacific region. Can you paint us a bit of a picture as to why bats are so important?
Yeah, look, bats are essential for ecosystem health. So they can kind of be loosely grouped into two groups based on the services that they provide for the ecosystem. So microbats, the smaller bats, they're insect eaters. And so each bat can consume about 1,000 insects per night. So they're really essential for insect control. And that includes things like eating mosquitoes, so essential for disease control. And then we have the flying foxes, the blossom bats, and the tube nose bats, which are all kind of fruit, nectar, and pollen eaters. And so after feeding on blossoms from one tree, they'll fly to another tree and to another tree, pollinating them as they go and dropping seeds as they fly. So they're really essential for maintaining healthy forests through pollination and seed dispersal. And so Yeah, as I said, there's some islands where, you know, they only have one bat species might be a flying fox, and that will be the sole native mammal on that island. And so they're like really keystone species, and without them providing that service, the ecosystem is in danger of collapse, like potentially removing habitat for other species.
I think a lot of people, when they think of pollination, they think of birds and they think of bees, but I don't think a lot of people think of bats as one of those keystone mammals that help with, you know, the pollination and helping keep the flora and fauna alive in a lot of Pacific Island nations. But also speaking about the importance, Nicola, there is a new regional group called PacBat. Why was it important to establish such a group and have that kind of connection in the region?
Yeah, so PacBat we set up just probably about a year ago now, Pacific Bat Conservation Network, and it's a consortium of organisations throughout the region. So just to name a few of the organisations, the Australasian Bat Society, Nature Fiji, Vanuatu Environment Science Society, and the Secretariat of the Pacific Regional Environment Programme. And it came together because it was really needed, as we know that there's a quarter of the Pacific bat species are threatened with extinction, and another about 15% we don't even know enough about them to determine their conservation status. And so there's the community organisations and researchers studying bats in the region, but the work is, you know, quite disjointed, and it's, as it's spread over, you know, those 10,000 islands of the Pacific, and often expertise and funding is lacking to conduct this work. So we saw joining together as a network with all these organisations in the greater Oceania region will, you know, open doors to these opportunities while, you know, still promoting that work remains in these communities and the nations of the Pacific Islands.
You're listening to bat ecologist Nicola Hanrahan, and we're talking about bats and the first ever Pacific Island Bat Conference in PacBat, and that's taken place last week. Now, Nicola, let's talk about the first Pacific Island Bat Conference. What were the main sort of outcomes? What were some of the workshops? How successful, in your mind, was this virtual conference?
Yeah, so it came together wonderfully. It actually exceeded our expectations. We had a suite of talks from people that live in the region, different community organizations and researchers that have been working in the region for years and years. Our focus for the talks was, you know, looking at those kinds of conservation initiatives that people in the region are conducting, and also what are these possible threats that we need to be paying attention to. And so we then had a series of three workshops where we brought everybody together and just discussed what are the key threats, you know, what are the research needs and the conservation needs that we have to carry out in order to have a better outcome for these bat species. And then we had a full day of technical workshops, so just training and things like bat field skills and acoustic analysis, you know, taking biological samples, so key things that are needed when you want to study bats. It was amazing. We had around 400 attendees over the 4 days, which far exceeded our expectations. Those 400 attendees came from over 40 countries around the world. So we were absolutely delighted with the participation there. And we also had 10 local hubs positioned on different Pacific islands. So, for example, we had some in the Solomons, in Palau, in Samoa. And so this allowed people in those regions to come together and to be able to discuss with people in their own community, and also access, you know, stable internet where that might be difficult to join something like a virtual conference normally. So it really was wonderful. We got, you know, the sharing of just a wealth of local knowledge.
And Nicola, you know, you mentioned there that some of the things on the agenda was talking about potential threats, or some of the threats that do exist for Pacific Island bat species. What are some of those threats, you know, if you can pinpoint a couple that do face Pacific Island bats and their decline potentially?
Yeah, sure. So one of the big ones would be habitat clearing. So that can be through a range of things, you know, whether that's logging or for agriculture or for, you know, urban expansion. Cyclones can also be quite detrimental to bat species, particularly the ones that are limited to just one island. You know, if a large cyclone comes through, it can really impact a large amount of the population. There's also other things like introduced species, you know, maybe introduced fauna that will prey upon the bats, or, you know, introduced flora that will change the habitat that's present there. And yeah, another important one would be hunting. So bats, particularly flying foxes, you know, play quite a huge role culturally on the Pacific Islands. And on some islands, bats still form part of their diet. And so it's, you know, working with people to kind of find that balance.
And Nicola, I have to ask you though, you know, why bats? Why did you choose to study bats? What is it about them that you love so much?
I think they're just fascinating. You know, they're, when you really start to look into them, you know, they're these animals that fly and are, you know, mostly active at night. You know, many of them operate in complete darkness and use, you know, echolocation to find these tiny little prey that flying around the air with them, and they're incredibly social. You know, they're quite similar to birds in that regard. They've got a lot of social calls. They sing to each other. They really are just, you know, the night shift that come on when the birds go to bed, take over the pollination. And yeah, I suppose I've been drawn to them because, you know, they're a bit of an underdog. You know, they do tend to be misunderstood and misrepresented. And so, yeah, I just want to, you know, help, I suppose, to clear up some of those misconceptions and show really how fascinating they are.
Well, I do have to ask, after the success of your first ever Pacific Island Bat Conference, what's next for PACBAT/the conference? Are you planning on organising another one in the coming years? What's the future of the work that you and Pacific Bat Conservation Network is doing?
Yeah, look, we'd love to have another one, and that's definitely a plan for the coming years. In the meantime, we really just want to strengthen this network that we've formed now and really keep that momentum up and try and get some, you know, key projects off the ground. You know, now that we have this group of 400 people that are all interested in protecting bats, I think there's so much that we can do together to improve those conservation outcomes.
Well, Nicola, thank you so much for joining me this morning on Pacific Beat to chat all things bat. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Mala.
Thank you. That was bat ecologist Nicola Hanrahan speaking to me there. Well, before we get a wrap of sports news, here's another song. This is Jivhana with Sun Ego Down.
It's been an hour. No need to cry, no need to worry, oh boy, I know you'll be here. It's been a while now, sitting here thinking about the way we went.
Now it's over.
Oh, don't you worry, boy, we got this, let's just talk and then we over.
We done, goodbye.
So come on closer, tell me your story, come on closer, tell me you love me, I don't know what to hear. Come on closer, tell me a story. Come on closer, tell me you love me. I don't know what to say.
That was Sun Ego Down featuring Leafy, Tipsy and Blaze by Jivhana from PNG. Well, it's time now to turn our attention to sports. And Richard Hewitt is with me this morning to take a look at some of the stories that have been hitting the headlines. Good morning again to you, Richard.
Good morning, Marla.
But firstly, we do have some quite awful breaking news about the coach of Tongan National Rugby and World Cup winning former Wallaby, Tautai Kefu. What's happened here?
Yeah, well, as it stands at the moment, based on the information that is circulating, mainly coming from Channel 7 News here in Australia,
Totai Kafu is in a dangerous situation in hospital. Basically, he's been stabbed in his home in Brisbane, we're told, while trying to defend his family. And it appears that three people broke into the home at 3 a.m. this morning. There was a brawl that erupted, and during that brawl, Totai Kafu was stabbed. He's taken to Princess Alexandra Hospital in a serious condition with abdominal wounds. Channel 7 tell us that Totai's wife, son and daughter were also injured in the stabbing rampage and taken to hospital. So he's clearly in a very serious condition. Former Wallaby, played 60 times for Australia, obviously of Tongan heritage, hence his role these days as coach of the Tongan national team. He won the World Cup with the Wallabies. So he's a big name in the rugby world, is Totai Kafu, a lovely man. He's always been very helpful to us here at Pacific Beat, and obviously we send him and his family the very best wishes and hope for a full recovery. I have been in touch with Peter Harding, who is the CEO of the Tongan Rugby Union. He's in Nuku'alofa. Tells me he's struggling to get any information. So clearly, you know, he wants to know as much as he can. He and Totai Kafu are big mates. They've worked together for a number of years. So he's in a very difficult position, clearly, because he will want to know as much as everybody else and trying to get to the facts of this situation. But a very awful situation emerging there.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, we do send our thoughts and towards the family and Totai Kafu as well to make a full recovery. But now to some other news, because we start with the controversial rugby union news out of the UK, with five British and Irish Lion greats asking for changes to the laws on substitutions. Otherwise, they fear a player could die on the field.
Yeah, this is what they're saying. I mean, it's a dramatic headline, but this is what they're suggesting could happen. This is coming in a statement in the form of an open letter, which is sent to the World Rugby Chairman, Sir Bill Beaumont, and the five British Lions greats over there in the UK, Sir Ian McGeoghegan, he's Scottish, Willie John McBride, who's Irish, and three Welshmen, Sir Gareth Edwards, Barry John and John Taylor. Each one of those five legendary figures in the world of rugby union over in the UK, and they say the game has become unnecessarily dangerous. Rugby union was conceived, they say, as a 15-a-side game for 30 players, with the current eight substitutes per side, many of whom they say are tactical impact players, or finishers, as they're called sometimes. They say this can and often does mean that 46 players get involved. And the letter adds that some players now prioritise what they describe as power over aerobic capacity, because basically they're not expected to play for the full 80 minutes, so they might come on for 20 minutes and just, you know, really go at it, crash bang. And this is what they're worried about, that you know, fresh players, strong players will come on and have a crack at players who've been out there for an hour or more and might not be quite as physically on the ball. They'll obviously be tired. What they say is this shapes the entire game, leading to more collisions, and in the latter stages, numerous fresh giants, as they say, crashing into tiring opponents. The simple change we advocate is to allow eight subs on the bench if you must, but limit the number that can be used to four, and then only in the case of injury. This move, they say, will make the game safer. Well, that's all well and good. There will be a lot of reaction from within the game and from supporters, I can tell you. But one tweet that's caught my eye, and I think this sums up the situation: a good idea, this person says, for safety, but it won't happen. Professional rugby is there for entertainment, and those making the money will want their product to be entertaining for the whole 80 minutes. And that's really what this is all about. It's making the game faster for longer. So there's going to be a big debate over that. But because it's all coming from the Northern Hemisphere, maybe things will happen, because we know here in the Southern Hemisphere, when we ask for change, nothing happens.
Wonder if it'll trickle down, if change does happen up there, and when it might potentially reflect here in the Southern Hemisphere. But Richard, now we're talking the Rugby Sevens World Series is set to resume after a very long break because of COVID-19, with two tournaments in Canada next month. But it looks like some big names will potentially be missing.
Well, the biggest of them all will be the newly crowned Olympic men's champions, Fiji. They won't be there, neither will the silver medalist New Zealand or Australia or Argentina or Samoa. So, quite frankly, I'm not entirely sure why they're bothering to have a tournament. But anyway, I should mention also the Olympic bronze medalist Fijiana won't be playing in the women's event. But, you know, it's pretty obvious why they're not going. There are concerns about COVID-19. COVID's travel restrictions are making it hard to get around the world. And in the case of the two Fijian teams, well, they spent a lot of months away from friends and family. Those players who are based in Fiji, which is most of them, have only just got back to the country. Some, in the case of the women, are still in quarantine. So really, this is all a bit of a bridge too far. But anyway, World Rugby have decided to go ahead with this tournament, but it seems to me pretty hollow if those teams are not involved. There are three other men's tournaments scheduled for later later in the year in Singapore, Dubai and Cape Town. But even if Fiji or Samoa were to make it to those, well, they'd be behind the eight ball because they missed out on the first two tournaments. So I don't see how whoever comes out of this at top could really say they were legitimate World Series champions.
You kept listing and I was like, oh, okay, so Fiji won't be there, yep, and then New Zealand and then Australia and then Argentina and then Samoa. And I thought, well, who's really left to play?
Well, yeah, I mean, South Africa, you would think, would be licking their lips because they would be in pole position. And, of course, England, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, France, Italy. Once again, it's all the Northern Hemisphere sides that will be there and the Southern Hemisphere sides saying, no thanks, it's just too risky for us.
Too risky. Now returning, though, to the NRL, and Melbourne Storm are hot favourites to add to their collection of premierships as their monster unbeaten streak continues. And one Pacific Island player in their ranks in particular is having a stellar season. I think people know who we're talking about, but who are we talking about?
We're talking about Justin Ollum, who's our favourite here at Pacific Beat. And Storm sit firmly on top of the ladder after extending their winning streak to 18 by defeating Canberra Raiders 26-10 in their round 22 match played on the Sunshine Coast. Samoa-born winger Dina Romero, incidentally, is just the fourth Storm player to come through the NRL Victoria Junior system. He was on the score sheet once again with a try. And Papua New Guinea international Justin Ollum, well, he continues to build his reputation as one of the hardest tacklers in the competition. And Justin is backing more players from PNG to make the grade in the NRL if they could just be given the opportunity.
I think there's heaps of players that are, you know, the better players that are there. But unfortunately for PNG players, that's not enough pathway to come to NRL. But in saying that, our PNG Hunters is doing a really good job to expose some of the players there. The big thing is coming from PNG, I don't think we have, you know, this good system to, you know, teach us about rugby league. So all the talents there are still fresh. All they need is a good system and I think, you know, good coaching place like Melbourne to help them get the talents out. When I first came here, I felt like I had to learn rugby league all over again.
Yeah, he certainly learned it fast, though, hasn't he? Justin Ollum and his Melbourne Storm teammates, they've already set a new club record for most points in a home and away season. And on Thursday night, when they take on the Gold Coast Titans, they'll be looking to equal the all-time Australian record of 19 wins in a row, set by the Sydney Roosters 46 years ago now in 1975. Meanwhile, in the Northern Hemisphere, Justin Ollum's national team captain, Reece Martin, is on the brink of breaking another rugby league record, playing for the English Super League team Leeds Rhinos. Martin hasn't missed a kick at goal for over a month. In his latest match, he kicked 7 out of 7 against the Lee Centurions, and now he needs just two more to break the record of 35 in a row that was set by Hazem El Masri for the Canterbury Bulldogs in the NRL back in 2003. Imagine that, not missing a kick for a month. That's
phenomenal. Can't, especially, you know, watching the Olympics, and I've been very much engrossed in a lot of sport. The idea that someone can't miss or hasn't missed a kick at goal for over a month, that's 4 weeks. That's a lot of games, a lot of goals and not a lot of misses, which is amazing. But like you said before, no doubt that the PNG fans here in Australia would love to see more PNG players kind of side by side with Justin Ollum, because he is a bit of a superstar here.
He is, but it took him a little while. He didn't just arrive in Australia and bang, he was a superstar. He had to work damn hard to get to where he is. And he was playing with the Sunshine Coast team, who are affiliated to Melbourne Storm. They play in the Queensland Cup alongside the PNG Hunters. And that, you know, Justin had to play a lot of games for them, and then eventually he got a chance in the Storm, and he was kind of in and out of the side. But now, I mean, he's regarded as one of the best around. He's an absolute superstar.
Superstar indeed. But now we've got to talk cricket, because there's a T20 World Cup on the horizon for Papua New Guinea, and the president of Vanuatu Cricket is celebrating 30 years on the job.
He is. That's Sir Mark Stafford. We'll hear from him in just a moment. But first, on the subject of the Barramundis, they're preparing to make their debut in the T20 World Cup finals in October. Now, the whole affair was meant to be played here in Australia last year and then India this year, but COVID-19 paid to both those options. And now the delayed tournament is set to go ahead in the United Arab Emirates and Oman. PNG will feature in the first round up against the test-playing nation Bangladesh, who just humiliated Australia in a T20 series just last week. They won that series 4-1. PNG will also be up against fellow associate nations Scotland and Oman, the host. The top two teams in that pool will go into the Super 12, as they call it, alongside Australia and all the other big guns, although maybe Australia are not quite such a big gun anymore. But clearly, no easy task for the Barramundis, which way you look at it. But they know both host countries well, having played a lot of matches in that part of the world in recent years, and they'll be heading out to the UAE and Oman for a warm-up tour at the end of this month under new coach Carl Sandri, the Australian-born former Italian international cricket player, would you believe? Meanwhile, to mark his 30 years as Vanuatu Cricket's president, Mark Stafford has been chatting to the Emerging Cricket podcast, and he wants to see Cricket New Zealand and Cricket Australia take a much more active role with the island nations in the East Asia-Pacific region.
Personally, I'd like to see Cricket Australia comes able to have an EAP under-15s championships, boys and girls, bring it all together in Cairns, Townsville or Darwin or something like that to take it away from the capital cities. But that be the catalyst for growth right throughout the region, the opportunity to bring the kids into focus in a pathway that we're missing at the present time. When we first started the EAP regional meeting, the first meeting was in Auckland in 2000, Australia and New Zealand were always represented. They don't always come now. It's something we should encourage, closer cooperation with our big brothers in the cricket region.
Mark Stafford there, president of Vanuatu Cricket since 1991. And it would be great to see Cricket Australia and Cricket New Zealand get more involved in the way he described there at junior level, and why not at senior level? There are certainly cricketers in Papua New Guinea and one or two in Vanuatu, male and female, who many believe would be worth a go in either Australia's T20 Big Bash or New Zealand's Super Smash. So maybe one for the future.
One for the future. But Richard, thank you so much, as always, for your sporting expertise. Really appreciate giving a wrap of sports news from around the region.
Pleasure, Marla.
Well, we're coming to the end of the program now, but I think we have time for one more track. This is a favourite of mine. This is Stan Walker with Bigger.
Damn, it feels so good on the other side, the other side. When you can be bigger, bigger than this. Listen to that good song beating in your chest. Don't be scared of stray too far from the river. You can be bigger, you can be bigger. That make you crazy. They're telling you the right things. Why we gotta think so small? When we can be bigger, yeah, yeah. Oh, bigger.
That was Stan Walker with Bigger there, and that brings us to the end of the program. But first, we got a message on our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page from Sungil Wee from PNG. They said that they would like to share their opinion about live streaming, saying that it's a great initiative, but they strongly believe that the dead still deserve respect and dignity. Therefore, it's only right to create a closed group on Facebook, which is a really interesting thought there. I'd love to know your thoughts. You can send me a message on our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. We can share them on the program as well. But like I said, that brings us to the end of the program. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow, that's 6 a.m. PNG time. And you can also catch us this afternoon. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though. I'm Marla Damati.